So, in again with compassion for those hurt or property lost by it, but we'll bow to the force of water, and so I'll talk to a little bit tonight about the floods. The Buddha used the word flood. The Pali is ogha, to refer to the, you know, as a simile for those forces of conditions that tend to sweep one away, and sometimes would use it as an image to refer to that which needs to be crossed. So crossed to the other side, and all of those, you know, the metaphor of like crossing to the other side of the river, or going to the other side, going beyond to the other side. At one point he says that. Make of yourselves an island. Right before he dies, he says, make of yourselves an island where it's like an island in a flooded river, so a place of refuge. This is really a side note on that, but the word for island is dīpa, and it's also the word for lamp. And so that closing instruction of the Buddha's gets variously translated as be an island unto yourself amid the stormy flood of the world, or make yourself into a lamp, like a lighthouse, perhaps, or like a lamp to guide others. And so you'll see both of those translations. They're translations of the same line, which is just really interesting to some, like myself. The Buddha talked about floods, and there's this beautiful text that I wrote about a bit today. It's the first discourse in the Connected Discourses, Samyutta Nikaya 1.1. And it has the Buddha at his favorite monastery, Anathapindika's Park, Jetta's Grove. And it says that one night, you know, deep into the night, a certain deva of surpassing beauty came to the grove bowed to the Buddha and stood to one side and said, Blessed One, how did you cross the flood? How did you do it? How did you become awakened? How did you get through the force in the world that pulls beings under? You know, how did you find freedom? And the Buddha says, Friend, by neither stopping nor straining, I crossed the flood. Neither stopping nor straining, I crossed the flood. And the deity really loves this and says a little poem about it, essentially repeating the same line, and then bows and disappears right there. So this happens frequently in the Buddha's life, actually. He's sitting up late at night teaching his monastics, and spirit beings show up and ask questions. So that's what that line in the chant means, teacher of gods and humans. Satta deva manusanam, teacher of humans and spirit beings. So this instruction, or the way the Buddha described his practice, by neither stopping nor straining, I crossed the flood, is often taken beautifully. I think it's a really helpful instruction around the kind of effort that we should bring to practice. It speaks a bit to both how to engage with a force that's quite powerful, and also how to engage on a path that can be quite long, right? When the Buddha fleshes it out, he says, when I stopped, I was taken under. And when I strained, I was swept away, but neither stopping nor straining, I crossed. And there's another text where he's talking about crossing a river. This is in Majjhima 64, and he describes the river Ganga, the Ganges, the river Ganga being, he said, imagine the river Ganga being so full with rain, full to the brim, as if a crow could drink out of it. That's the standard image for a body of water being very, very full, is that a crow stands on the end and can drink out of it. So it's not down at all. So the Ganga is so full that a crow could drink out of it. He says, monks, do you think that a feeble person, a person weak of body, could they cross that? And the monks say, you know, blessed one, no, they couldn't. You know, just so, monks, and just so, monastics, a person who has not developed the path, a person who's weak in the qualities of the path, beset by the hindrances, doesn't have strong discipline, doesn't have strong precepts, for that person to really understand the dharma that goes beyond identity, beyond fixed view, beyond the conceptual framework that's easy to understand, it would be impossible. He said that person would get swept away. And so what is the Buddha talking about being swept away by? It's a beautiful metaphor. So what exactly is this water, this flood that sweeps one away? The Buddha said, there's four floods. So this is one of the classic lists, not taught on as much. These are the four floods, ogha. The first flood is the flood of sensuality, kama, desire. And so you might think of a moment when sensual desire arose in you, and think about the kind of force that exerts on your psyche, on your body, on your being, on your heart. How, in a certain way, irresistible that is. How hard to resist that is. I'm not sure how we stumbled on it, but this past couple of weeks, my son, who's 7, has become enraptured with the musical Hamilton. So we're listening to Hamilton, but we only really ever get through the first few songs, which is fine because they're awesome, and that's enough in a certain way. But some way further into the show, there's, I don't know if you know the show, spoiler alert, he cheats on his wife. So there's a song where Hamilton's wife and her sister, who he's in love with both of them, but he doesn't cheat with the sister. The two of them go to upstate New York for the summer. They want him to come be with them and the kid. He says, no, I have to work. I have to get this thing through Congress. You know, he's creating the Federal Reserve. No big deal, right? So he stays in New York to work, but he gets seduced or he becomes enraptured with a woman who's there, who's also married to someone else. And the song that they kind of build around this moment of him, falling out of faithfulness to his wife, is a song about how difficult it is to say no. And he's really saying like, I want to say no, I should say no, I know I'm supposed to say no, but somehow I can't say no. And so this is the flood of sensuality, right? That there's, I don't know if you've ever, misbehaved or lost track of your precepts for a moment when under the flood of sensuality, but that's one of the ones that gets folks, right? It's one of the great floods that carries one away. And the way that it carries you away is that it takes away, or it weakens, the power of mindfulness, of discernment, and of ethical determination, right? So you've made some precepts. You've taken the third precept. You know, I take the training precept to refrain from sexual misconduct. And then here comes the flood of sensuality, and it comes in the form of a mental image or a storyline or a physical presence of someone. And it might not be sexual, it might be a different kind of sensory thing that you crave, but sexuality is the kind of paradigm of that really has this force in the body, heart, mind being. And so it sweeps one away. So in the metaphor, you know, if I stopped, like if I just like try to stand there and I'm trying to withstand this force, I went under. And if I tried to strain against it, I got swept away. And it's interesting in the translation, and I wrote about this a bit this afternoon, that line, neither stopping nor straining, I cross the flood, can also be translated, or is variously translated, and this is Bhikkhu Sujato's translation, by neither standing nor swimming, I cross the flood. And the word that gets translated as straining here, in the Pali Dictionary, it more has the sense of straining, striving, forceful pushing. So I prefer that as a translation. But the thing I like about neither standing nor swimming is this sense that it really complies with the metaphor. And there's a way that, you know, in a rushing river, you don't mostly try to swim across. If you can, you walk across, keeping your feet on the ground, if it's shallow enough. You're far more likely to maintain your footing and, you know, make a straight line across if you can. So the flood of sensuality then, next time, you know, sensual desire arises in you, whether or not it's, you know, well bounded in the form of a, you know, consensual relationship and, you know, or however it comes, see if you can notice then just the force that it comes with and say this, oh, this is a flood. And, you know, if going with it within the bounds of keeping the precepts and, you know, consent and all that, if it's wholesome to go with it, then that's wonderful, right? That's a beautiful part of human life. But you can still learn by feeling it, by being mindful of it, how much of a flood it is. And then you can be grateful that you're in a situation in this moment where it's appropriate to go with it. But it's tremendously helpful to understand how strong it is, so that when you find yourself in a situation where it's not appropriate to go with it, and we always do at some point, you know what's going on, and you could say, ah, you know, by swimming I got swept away. It's like, okay, just watch out for that one. So the first flood is sensuality, kama. The second flood of the four is one translation is existence. I like the translations becoming or identity. The Pali word is bhava. And this is the bhava is being in a kind of literal sense. But in the Buddhist model, mostly bhava means the arising of the sense of being something or someone, existing as something or someone because of certain conditions. And I think for a lot of us in practice, it's most helpful to think of this in terms of identities. So, you know, I carry the identity of being mixed race, for instance, coming from English and Puerto Rican heritage. In some conditions, it's really helpful to give rise to that identity. You know, there's been moments when that's been really empowering. There's been moments when it's enabled me to connect with mixed race folks in a kind of dialogue of being able to say like, oh, here's some of my experience, here's some of your experience. There's enough shared that we can uplift each other in trying to understand the experience of being mixed race in this culture. There's other times when that identity framework is less useful. Even times where if I were to fixate on it, like if I held that, you know, as it really in the foreground of my attention, that would, in a sense, block or even preclude something else that might happen. You know, I've had moments where I'm thinking a lot about race as an identity channel quality and getting into the wholesomeness of identifying as mixed race or, you know, within my particular heritage. And I've worked myself into a sufficient lather around it that I have been then not just more uncomfortable than usual in primarily white spaces, but actually kind of worked myself into a kind of aversion to white people, which is understandable for many folks, very understandable. For myself, it's a little bit absurdly understandable because I was raised completely embedded in whiteness and feeling like I was completely white. I didn't really learn that I was Puerto Rican until deep into my 20s. And no one ever told me that I was browner than everyone else around me. And for whatever reason, I didn't notice. And so whiteness was never a problem until I made it a problem in a certain way, for me personally. And that's not true for lots of folks, you know, who really live with the you know, oppression and suffering of racial categories and identities, you know, on a daily basis and have to wrestle with that. I wasn't forced to wrestle with it. And then later on, when I took it on and reflected on it, and there were times when I almost internally went, you know, I don't even know that it was too far, but I would say that there was a little bit of getting swept away. When that becomes the only category through which I'm seeing the world becomes narrower, became narrower for me. And it was helpful to deconstruct that with some mindfulness and to understand and be like, oh, I'm young in this discourse and I was raised in this way, and to really tease out for myself how to hold that identity. And that can be true for so many identities that we carry. Right now in this country, the United States, but it's true in many countries around the world, and you know, a kind of national identity, particularly different kinds of religious or ethno-national identities, have really been stirred up. And so, you know, the flood of becoming, or the flood of identity, we might understand as being behind some of the big, you know, political moments recently, right? We just came through the anniversary of the January 6th attacks on the US Capitol, and then we just witnessed a kind of related but different attack on the Brazilian capital following the election of Lula down in Brazil, but similarly a kind of flowering of an intense kind of nationalist identity in the right wing flavor there. So becoming in the form of identity or existence becomes a flood that can sweep one away. The third of the floods, the Ogha, is views, ditti, and ditti, worldviews, seeing the world in a certain way. And here we can remember the last stanza of the Metta Sutta, by not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. The Buddha would say that, you know, like the first of the eight limbs of the Eightfold Path is view, right view, samma ditti. Ditti is how we understand the world, really in a very deep way. So, you know, views include things like what I believe or hold about, you know, who I am or what kind of people I am, what happens after death, whether God exists, what it means to be alive, how I hold actions and their effects, how I understand difference and how people relate. This is kind of deep worldview level things. Scientific materialism is a kind of profound view that excludes things like devas, for instance, spirit beings showing up to say hello to the Buddha in a blaze of glorious beauty. You know, it's a view that would deny the existence of rebirth. It's also a view that would hold rigidly to an idea of rebirth, you know, having to be a certain way. Anytime an idea or a concept has taken root in our heart, mind, and is in such a way that it becomes unconsidered, you know, unavailable to new information, argumentative, solidified, making difference, you know, knowing that I'm right about something and making the other wrong, creating self and other at all of that is view. And so view, in a certain way, it's a flood. It's the kind of flood, not like the first flood of sensuality, which kind of comes and goes, and for a while maybe leaves you in peace, and then comes as a flood, you know, in a moment. Views is the kind of flood that I think often we, it's not that they come in a moment, it's more like we've already been swept away by them a long time ago. Like we grew up floating away in an ocean of views, you know. Recovering from a view is a thing. So, you know, if you were raised in a certain religion and you had a moment where you had to figure out what you actually believed in relation to that, that's almost like I spent my whole life floating down the river of this view. Like I never had a foothold. And at one point, you know, I grab a branch and I'm like, wait, what if I'm not Catholic? You know, and that whole view just starts to go like, and so it might be hard to notice the flood of views in its arising, right? With mindfulness, you want to know when something's arising and when it's dissolving and when it's sustaining. With views, I think often we notice they're sustaining. Like you can bring mindfulness to something you believe. Do you really often get to shine a light on the moment when that belief arises? That's a really interesting moment. You know, you might be able to remember a moment when you encountered something and it was the first moment when it made sense to you and it kind of took root in you. And it doesn't matter in a certain way whether it's true or not. Like it could have been a wonderful thing. I remember when the idea of rebirth first really hit me and it made sense to me. It's still a view. And to the extent, to whatever extent I may have at times, you know, grabbed a hold of that view and become a little fundamentalist about it, that would be being swept away by it. You know, I kind of lost my footing in it. We can remember that, you know, even the Dharma is views. And the Buddha would say, you know, in the Kalama Sutta, to the Kalamas of Kesaputta, you know, very famously, you know, don't believe a teaching of you. Don't believe it because, you know, a famous person said it, or I said it, or because it came supported by someone of high caste, or because it made logical sense to you, or because you worked it out on your own, or because, he gives a whole nice list. He says, you know, but only when you have directly experienced the truth of something for yourself in an unmistakable way, then you can know that it's true. And so I think working with the flood of views is partly about getting some footing at all amid the views that we already carry. And this is where mindfulness really can become, you know, a beautiful form of like philosophical skepticism. Because you could take you could really ask yourself, you know, what do I really believe about myself, about who I am, about the world? First of all, it's hard to sometimes even identify these things. That's why big religious or existential questions can sometimes be, you know, can stir things up so much, right? Do my actions really matter? You know, why is there evil? They try to answer the great ancient questions that people smarter than ourselves worked for a couple thousand years on. The point is not that you come up with an answer, but that it reveals what you've been taught. And so, you know, and you can do this with big political views too. You know, what do I actually think or feel about racial difference? What do I actually think or feel about wealth? You know, how do I actually relate to money or sex or power or, you know, all the biggies? And you'll come up with views. And then to those views, you can bring the discernment practice of the Dharma. And, you know, you can ask, is it true? How do I think this is true? you know, what's, from what positionality, from what social location do I think this is true? And can I put myself in, you know, or project myself into another social location and see how this is not actually true from that social location or from that, that other identity? And unpacking views, becoming free from the flood of views, points toward emptiness, right? Because all of these things that we, that comprise our identity, this becoming, you know, views give rise to becoming. So those two are really linked. As we pull the rug out from under views and identity, right, it's emptiness. That both of those point to emptiness. And so the last of the floods is ignorance itself, avidya, not knowing, not seeing clearly. And so in a way you can see how they're all connected. With ignorance as a basis, we don't see clearly. Not seeing clearly, we're subject to views and we're unable to be clear about what we really believe. Views give rise to identities that really fixate us in being a certain person, being a certain way. All of that is kind of the condition in which we live. And then we get slammed by floods of sensuality. That's the picture, right? Like, good luck out there. Wear your waders. And so with practice, you know, mindfulness and discernment practice and reflection and inquiry points toward, you know, unpacking these things that are hard to see clearly, views and identity. As we do that, ignorance subsides and wisdom grows, right? We see more clearly who we are, what we believe, what we know to be true through direct experience. And then sensuality is met with the, you know, the strength of the precepts, the strength of discernment, the strength of renunciation, of just being able to let go, being able to tolerate the discomfort of the force of the sensual flood, and maintaining, you know, the ability, the agency to act skillfully in relation to it. And so with all of them, there's a sense that the effort required is steady, you know, neither stopping nor straining across the flood. You know, with the difficult ones, views and identity, I think the not stopping means, you know, in part growing a kind of underlying attitude of inquiry that we take with us everywhere. And in a way, it shares some qualities with deconstruction as a cultural attitude, you know, with an idea that everything comes in context and with many layers. So then when I see things, I want to see the layers that are there, right? So, you know, in the taqueria the other day, I'm with my kid and it's football season, so there's American football up on the screens, and, you know, he's like, who are we rooting for? And I'm like, I don't know. He's like, well, I like the orange team. And I'm like, let's root for the orange team. I think it was Cincinnati versus somebody in gray or blue or some less fun color. So we went for orange. On the other screen was the Raiders, and we were like Oakland. So, okay, even though they're not quite Oakland anymore, but we were like Oakland. And so many layers are present, you know, like I'm aware of my son's pleasure at seeing them run around, and I'm aware of my aversion to American football as a sport, and I'm aware of you know, all of the people with, like, prayers for Damar Hamlin, who was injured very badly on the field a couple weeks ago and is doing better but still in critical condition, and I'm aware of the commercialization, and I'm aware of the industry, and I'm aware of advertisements, and I'm aware of, you know, color, and I'm aware of the, you know, the thinly clad cheerleaders at the edge of the field. And so I'm aware of patriarchy, and I'm aware of sexism, and I'm aware of capitalism, and I'm aware of big men in helmets, and I'm aware of race, and it's like, that's right. Everything is there. Everything is present. And I think it's appropriate to develop an attitude of a kind of critical wakefulness to everything, because that is what undercuts both views and identity as floods. And because any particular thing I believe about any of those things, I could investigate, and I could, you know, there's a, every one of those is a rabbit hole you can go down. And with the support of seeing views, what you can do is you can know really that, you know, every aspect of that thing that, you know, that you could go on infinitely pulling out details and threads of, every aspect of that is connected to so many other things, right? And all of it is conditional. All of it is like, right, these people did this, and then it became this, and this became this, and this affected this. And so it all filters down in a way to, you know, the basics of the path, which is that actions matter, right? Sila, ethics is the heart of the whole thing. You respect ethics more the more you see interconnectedness and conditionality. And as you see that, fixed views always dissolve, right? Because a view can only be fixed if it thinks it's the foundation upon which everything else is built. Like it says, like, oh, this is true, you know, in a kind of flat line sort of way. But nothing is, you know? And the Dharma itself is not exempt from this. The Dharma is empty like everything else, you know? And that's really a paradox, because it becomes necessary to develop profound, passionate, heartfelt faith in this thing, while at the same time understanding that it's a historically conditioned phenomena that arose in the context of cultures and people and reflects those cultures and people, and, you know, and so even the view of being Buddhist or being a Dharma practitioner or having taken refuge or any of these things that are very wholesome, even that can be a flood that can sweep one away and toward fundamentalism or other forms of identity and, you know, fixation. And so to let go even of that, and instead just the action of steadily walking, not stopping, not straining. And, you know, when you do that, the water goes around you, right? You cut through the water, stay sideways to the water, and go across. And just keep going. And you're just looking for the next stable place to lodge your feet amid the stones and make it across. All right, pausing there for now. May all beings be safe from the floods, and find the refuge of the other shore.